Tongues wavered against the sky in a blood-stained sunset, and the smoke rose and spread over the valley. He saw it was the comet burning. Outdistancing the troop, he galloped into Merin. Among the warriors from the camp, Taran glimpsed Ailanwy and Gurgi struggling vainly to quench the flames. Karl had reached the village before him. Taran leapt from Melinlas and ran to his side.
"Too late," Karl cried. "The raiders circled and stormed the comet from the rear. Merin has been put to the torch, and its folk to the sword."
With a terrible cry of grief and rage, Taran ran past the blazing cottages. The thatch had burned from the roofs, and many of the walls had split and crumbled. So it was with the hut of Anlor, which still smouldered, its ruins open to the sky. The body of the potter lay amid the rubble. Of the work of his hands, all had been shattered. The wheel was overturned, the bowl flung into pieces. Taran dropped to his knees. Karl's hand was on his shoulder, but he drew himself away and stared up at the old warrior. "Did I shout for victory today?" he whispered hoarsely. "Small comfort to folk who once befriended me. Have I served them well? The blood of Merin is on my hands." Later, Lassa spoke apart with Karl. "The wanderer has not stirred from the potter's hut," the shepherd murmured. "It is harsh enough for each man to bear his own wound, but he who leads bears the wounds of all who follow him." Karl nodded.
"Leave him where he chooses to be. In the morning he will be well," he added, "though likely never healed."
By midwinter, the last of the warbands had been gathered, and the comet warriors dispatched to Caer Dathil. In addition to a troop of horsemen, Lassa, Hevid, and Lonio still remained with Taran, who now led the companions northwestward through the Lorgadden Mountains. The force was strong enough to safeguard their progress without slowing their journey. Twice marauders attacked them, and twice Taran's followers beat them off, inflicting heavy losses. The raiders, having learned a bitter lesson from the war leader who rode under the ensign of the White Pig, slunk away and dared harass the columns no further. The companions passed swiftly and unhindered through the foothills of the Eagle Mountains. Gurgi still proudly carried the banner, which snapped and fluttered in the sharp winds, lashing from the distant heights. In his cloak, Taran bore one talisman, a shard of broken, fire-blackened pottery from Comet Merin. At the approaches to Caer Dathil, outriders brought word of still another host. Taran galloped ahead. In a vanguard of spearmen rode Fluda Flam.
"Great Belin!" shouted the bard, urging Lian to Taran's side. "Gwydion shall rejoice. The northern lords arm in all their strength. When a Flam commands..." "Yes, well, I did rally them in the name of Gwydion. Otherwise they might not have been so willing. But no matter, they're on the way. I've heard King Pryderi, too, has raised his armies. Then you'll see a battle host. I dare say half the western cantrevs are under his command." "Oh, yes," Fluda added, as Taran caught sight of Glue perched atop a sway-backed, heavy-hoofed grey horse. "The little fellow is still with us."
The former giant, busily gnawing a bone, gave Taran only a scant sign of recognition.
"I didn't know what to do with him," said Fluda in a low voice. "I hadn't the heart to send him packing, not in the midst of all the armies gathering. So here he is. He's not stopped whining and complaining. His feet hurt one day, his head the next, and little by little all the rest of him. Then, in between meals, he goes on with his endless tales of when he was a giant. The worst of it is," Fluda went on in some dismay, "he's given my ears such a drubbing that he's made me almost feel sorry for him. He's a small-hearted weasel, always was and always will be. But as you stop and think on it, he has been considerably mistreated and put upon. Now, when Glue was a giant..."
The bard interrupted himself and clapped a hand to his forehead.
"Enough! Any more of his chatter, and I'll end by believing it. Come, join us,"
he cried, unslinging his harp from the tangle of bows, quivers of arrows, bucklers, and leather strapping he bore on his back.
"All friends are met again. I'll play you a tune to celebrate and keep us warm at the same time."
Cheered by the bard's music, the companions journeyed on together. Soon the high fortress of Caer Dathil rose golden in the winter sunlight. Its mighty bastions sprang up like eagles, impatient for the sky. Beyond the walls encircling the fortress stood the camps and flag-decked pavilions of lords, come in allegiance to the royal house of Don. Yet it was not the sight of the banners or the wind-tossed emblems of the golden sunburst that made Taran's heart leap, but rather the knowledge that the companions and comet warriors had come safe to the end of one journey, to warmth and rest for a little time at least. Safe. Taran halted in his own thoughts, and the memories returned, of Rún, king of Mona, who slept silent before the gates of Caer Cadan, of Anlor Clayshaper, and his fingers clenched around the fragment of pottery. Chapter 10. The Coming of Pryderi. Caer Dathil was an armed camp, where sparks like blazing snowflakes whirled from the armorer's forges. Its wide-spreading courtyards rang with the iron-shod hooves of warhorses and the sharp notes of signal horns. Although the companions were now safe within its walls, the Princess Ailanwy declined to exchange her warrior's rough garb for more befitting attire. The most she agreed to do, and that reluctantly, was to wash her hair. A few ladies of the court remained, the rest having been sent to the protection of the eastern strongholds, but Ailanwy flatly refused to join them in their spinning and weaving chambers.
"Caer Dathil may be the most glorious castle in Prydain," she declared, "but court ladies are court ladies wherever you find them, and I've had more than my share with Queen Teleria's hen flock. Listening to their giggling and gossiping, why, it's worse than having your ears tickled with feathers. For the sake of being a princess, I've been half-drowned with soapy water, and that's quite enough. My hair still feels clammy as seaweed. As for skirts, I'm comfortable just as I am. I've lost all my robes anyway, and I certainly shan't bother to be measured for others. The clothes I'm wearing will do very nicely."
"No one has considered asking me whether my clothing is suitable,"
Glue testily remarked, although the former giant's garments, as far as Taran could judge, were in better repair than those of the companions.
"But shabby treatment is something I've grown used to. In my cavern, when I was a giant, things were much different. Generosity, alas, gone forever. Now I recall when the bats and I—"
Taran had neither strength to dispute Ailanwy's words, nor time to listen to Glue's. Gwydion, hearing of the companions' arrival, had summoned Taran to the Hall of Thrones, while Carl, Fluder and Gergi secured gear and provisions for the warriors who had journeyed with them. Taran followed a guard to the hall. Finding Gwydion in council with Math, son of Mathonwy, Taran hesitated to draw closer, but Math beckoned to him, and Taran dropped to one knee before the white-bearded ruler. The High King touched Taran's shoulder with a hand withered but firm, and bade him rise. Not since the battle between the Sons of Don and the armies of the Horned King had Taran been in the presence of Math, son of Mathonwy, and he saw the years had borne heavily upon the monarch of the royal house. The face of Math was even more careworn and more deeply furrowed than Dalban's. Upon his brow, the gold crown of Don seemed a cruel burden. Yet his eyes were keen and filled with stern pride. More than this, Taran sensed a sorrow so profound that his own heart grieved, and he bowed his head.
"Face me, assistant peak-keeper," Math commanded in a quiet voice. "Fear not to see what I myself know. The hand of death reaches toward mine, and I am not loath to clasp it. I have long heard the horn of Gwyn the Hunter that summons even a king to his barrow home." "With a glad heart would I answer it," said Math, "for a crown is a pitiless master, harsher than the staff of a peak-keeper.
while a staff bears up. A crown weighs down, beyond the strength of any man to wear it lightly. What grieves me is not my death, but at the end of my life, to see blood spilled in the land where I sought only peace. You know the history of our royal house, how long ago the sons of Don voyaged in their golden ships to Prydain, and how men sought their protection against Aron, Deathlord, who had robbed Prydain of its treasures and turned a rich, fair land into a fallow field. Since then the sons of Don have stood as a shield against the ravages of Anuvin. But if the shield now be riven, then all shatters with it.
We will gain victory, Gwydion said. The lord of Anuvin stakes all upon this venture, but his strength is also his weakness, for it may be that if we withstand him, his power will shatter for ever. Good tidings as well as bad have reached us, Gwydion went on. For the latter, King Smoit and his armies are embattled in the valley of Ystrad. He cannot, for all his boldness, force his way farther northward before the end of winter. He serves us well, nonetheless, since his warriors engage the traitors among the southern lords and keep them from joining Aron's other battle hosts. The more distant kings in the northern realms come but slowly, for winter to them is a sterner enemy than Aron. More heartening is word that the armies of the West Domains are but a few days' march from our stronghold. Scouts have already sighted them. It is a host greater than any ever raised in Prydain, and Lord Pryderi himself commands them. He has done all I prayed from him, and more. My only unease is that Oron's liegemen may give battle and turn him aside before he reaches Caer Dathil. But, if so, we will have warning, and our forces will march to relieve him. Not least among our good tidings, Gwydion added, a smile lightening his drawn and haggard features, is the coming of Taran of Caer Dalban, and the warriors led from the Comets. I have counted heavily upon him, and shall ask still more.
Gwydion spoke then of the ordering of Taran's horsemen and unmounted troops. The High King listened closely and nodded his agreement.
"Go now to your task," said Math to Taran, "for the day is come when an assistant peacekeeper must help bear the burden of a king."
During the days that followed, the companions served wherever need arose, and as Gwydion commanded them. Even Glue shared, to some extent, in the toil, at the forceful insistence of Fluda Flam, and not through his own choice. Under the watchful eye of Hevid the Smith, the former giant was set to pumping bellows at the forges, where he complained unstintingly of the blisters on his pudgy hands. More than a stronghold of war, Caer Dathil was a place of memory and a place of beauty. Within its bastions, in the farther reaches of one of its many courtyards, grew a living glade of tall hemlocks, and among them rose mounds of honour to ancient kings and heroes. Halls of carved and ornamented timbers held panoplies of weapons of long and noble lineage, and banners whose emblems were famed in the songs of the bards. In other buildings were stored treasures of craftsmanship sent from every cantrev and comet in Prydain. There, Taran saw, with a twinge of heart, a beautifully fashioned wine jar from the hands of Anlor Clayshaper. The companions, when spared from their tasks, found much of wonder and delight. Carl had never before journeyed to Caer Dathil, and he could not help staring at the archways and towers that seemed to soar higher than the snow-capped mountains beyond the walls.
"Handsome enough it all is," Carl admitted, "and skilfully worked. But the towers make me think my apple-trees should have been better pruned. And left to itself, my garden will yield as much as the stones of this courtyard."
A man called out to them and beckoned from the doorway of one of the smallest and plainest of the buildings. He was tall, his face deeply weathered. White hair fell straight to his shoulders. The coarse cloak of a warrior was flung loosely about him, but neither sword nor dagger hung at his unadorned leather belt. As the companions followed, Fluda ran instantly to the man and, heedless of the snow, dropped to one knee before him.
"Perhaps it is I who should bow to you, Fluda Flam, son of Godo,"
said the man, smiling, "and ask your pardon." He turned to the companions and offered his hand. "I know you better than you know me," he said, and laughed good-heartedly at their surprise. "My name is Taliesin."
"The chief bard of Prydain," said Fluda, beaming proudly and delightedly, "made me a gift of my harp. I am in his debt."
"Of that I am not altogether sure," replied Taliesin, as the companions followed him through the doorway and into a spacious chamber, lightly furnished, with only a few sturdy seats and benches, and a long table of curiously grained wood that glowed in the light of a cheery hearth fire. Ancient volumes, stacks and rolls of parchment crowded the walls and rose high into the shadows of the raftered ceiling.
"Yes, my friend," the chief bard said to Fluda, "I have often thought of that gift. Indeed, it has been a little on my conscience."
He gave the bard a glance that was shrewd, but filled with kindness and good humour. Taran at first had seen Taliesin as a man of many years. Now he could not guess the chief bard's age. Taliesin's features, though heavily lined, seemed filled with a strange mixing of ancient wisdom and youthfulness. He wore nothing to betoken his rank, and Taran realized there was no need for such adornment. Like Adean, his son, and Taran's companion of long ago, his eyes were grey, deep-set, seeming to look beyond what they saw, and there was in the chief bard's face and voice a sense of authority far greater than a war leader's and more commanding than a king's.
"I knew the nature of the harp when I gave it to you," the chief bard continued, "and, knowing your own nature, suspected that you would always have some small trouble with the strings."
"Trouble?" cried Fluda. "Why, not a bit of it. Never for a moment."
Two strings broke with such a twang that Gergi started in alarm. Fluda's face turned bright red to the tip of his nose.
"The fact of the matter is, as I stop and think on it, the old pots forced me to tell the truth, shall we say, a little more than I normally would. But it does occur to me, telling the truth has harmed no one, least of all myself."
Taliesin smiled.
"Then you have learned no small lesson."
"Nonetheless, my gift was in jest, yet not entirely in jest. Say, perhaps, the laughter of one heart to another. But you have borne it willingly. Now I offer you any of your choosing," he said.
Taliesin pointed to a shelf where stood a number of harps, some newer, some older, and a few even more gracefully curved than the instrument Fluda carried. With a joyful cry, Fluda hastened to them, lovingly touching the strings of each, admiring the workmanship, turning from one to the next and back again. He hesitated some while, looking dolefully at the newly broken strings of his own instrument, at the scratches and chips scarring the frame.
Yes, well, you honour me," he murmured in some confusion, "but this old pot is quite good enough for me. There are times, I swear, when it seems to play of itself. None has a better tone, when the strings are fixed, that is. It sits well against my shoulder. Not to belittle these, but what I mean is that somehow we're used to each other. Yes, I'm most grateful, but I would not change it."
"So be it, then," replied Taliesin. "And you others," the chief bard added to the companions, "you have seen many of the treasures of Caer Dathil. But have you seen its true pride and priceless treasure? It is here," he said quietly, gesturing around the chamber. "Stored in this hall of law is much of Prydain's ancient learning. Though a Rhaun Deathlord robbed men of their craft secrets, he could not gain the songs and sayings of our bards. Here they have been carefully gathered. Of your songs, my gallant friend," he said to Fluda, "there are not a few."
"Memory lives longer than what it remembers," Taliesin said, "and all men share the memories and wisdom of all others. Below this chamber lie even richer troves," he smiled, "like poetry itself, the greater part is the more deeply hidden. There, too, is the Hall of Bards."
"Alas, Fluda Flam," he said regretfully, none but a true bard may enter it. For one day, perhaps, you shall join our company."
"Oh, wisdom of noble bards!"
cried Gergi, his eyes popping in wonderment.
"It makes humble Gergi's poor tender head spin with whirlings and twirlings. Alas, alas, for he has no wisdom. But he would go without crunchings and munchings to gain it."
Taliesin put a hand on the creature's shoulder. "Do you believe you have none?" he said. "That is not true. Of wisdom there are as many patterns as a loom can weave. Yours is the wisdom of a good and kindly heart. Scarce it is, and its worth all the greater." "Such is that of Karl, son of Karlfruer," said the chief bard, "and added thereto the wisdom of the earth, the gift of waking barren ground and causing the soil to flourish in a rich harvest."
"My garden does that labour, not I,"
said Karl, his bald crown turning pink from both pleasure and modesty.
"And as I recall the state I left it in, I shall wait long for another harvest, whatever."
"I was to gain wisdom on the Isle of Mona," put in Ilanwe. "That's why Dalban sent me there. All I learned was needlework, cooking, and curtsying."
"Learning is not the same as wisdom," Taliesin interrupted with a kindly laugh. "In your veins, princess, flows the blood of the enchantresses of Lea. Your wisdom may be the most secret of all, for you know without knowing, even as the heart itself knows how to beat."
"Alas for my own wisdom," said Taran. "I was with your son when he met his death. He gave me a brooch of great power, and while I wore it, there was much I understood, and much that was hidden grew clear to me. The brooch is no longer mine, if indeed it ever truly was. What I knew then, I remember only as a dream lingering beyond my power to grasp it."
A shade of sorrow passed over Taliesin's face. "There are those," he said gently, "who must first learn loss, despair, and grief. Of all paths to wisdom, this is the cruelest and longest. Are you one who must follow such a way? This even I cannot know. If you are, take heart nonetheless. Those who reach the end do more than gain wisdom. As rough wool becomes cloth, and crude clay a vessel, so do they change and fashion wisdom for others, and what they give back is greater than what they won."
Taran was about to speak, but the notes of a signal horn rang from the middle tower, and shouts rose from the guardians at the turrets. Watchers cried out the sighting of King Pryderi's battle host. Taliesin led the companions up a broad flight of stone steps where, from atop the Hall of Law, they could see beyond the walls of the fortress. Taran could only glimpse the gleam of the westering sun on ranks of spears across the valley. Then, mounted figures broke away from the mass and galloped across the snow-flecked expanse. Against the rolling meadow, the leading rider of the band was sharply brilliant in trappings of crimson, black, and gold, and sunlight sparkled on his golden helmet. Taran could watch no longer, for guards were shouting the names of the companions, summoning them to the great hall. Catching up the banner of the white pig, Gergi hastened after Taran. The companions quickly made their way to the great hall. A long table had been placed there, and at its head sat Math and Gwydion. Taliesin took his seat at Gwydion's left hand. To the right of Math stood an empty throne, draped in the colours of King Pryderi's royal house. On either side sat the lords of Don, Cantref nobles, and war leaders. Circling the hall stood the banner-bearers. Gergi glanced about him in dismay, but, at a gesture from Gwydion, stationed himself among their ranks. The poor creature looked miserable and frightened out of his wits amid the stern warriors, but the companions turned encouraging eyes on him, and Karl gave him such a huge grin and a wink that Gergi raised both his shaggy head and his makeshift banner more proudly than any in the great hall. Taran himself felt no little awkwardness when Gwydion signalled for him and the others to take seats among the war leaders, though Ilanwe, still in her warrior's attire, smiled happily and seemed altogether at ease.
"Humph," she remarked, "I think Hen Wen shows up quite handsomely, and for the matter of that, better than most. You were so disagreeable about whether her eyes were blue or brown. Well, I can tell you that's not half as strange as the colours they've embroidered on some of these banners.
Ailanwy stopped speaking, for the portals were flung open, and King Pryderi entered the great hall. All eyes were on him as he strode toward the council table. He was as tall as Gwydion himself, and his rich raiment glittered in the torchlight. He wore no helmet. What Taran had seen was his long hair, that shone like gold about his brow. At his side hung a naked sword, for it was Pryderi's custom, as Fluda whispered to Taran, never to sheathe his blade until the battle was won. Behind him followed falconers with hooded hawks on their gauntleted wrists. His war leaders, with the crimson hawk emblem of the House of Powell broidered on their cloaks, and spearmen flanking his banner-bearer. Gwydion, clothed like the chief bard, in the unadorned garb of a warrior, stood to greet him. But Pryderi halted before reaching the council table, and, arms folded, glanced around the hall at the waiting cantre of kings.
"Well met, lords," Pryderi cried. "I rejoice to see you gathered here. The threat of Anuvin makes you forget your own quarrelling. Once more, you seek protection from the House of Don, like fledglings who see the hawk circling."
Pryderi's voice rang with unhidden scorn. Taran started at the king's harsh speech. The High King himself looked sharply at Pryderi, though when he spoke his words were measured and grave.
"How then, Lord Pryderi? It is I who summoned all who will stand with us, for the safety of all hangs in the balance."
Pryderi smiled bitterly. His handsome features were flushed, whether from the cold or from anger, Taran could not tell. Blood tinged Pryderi's high, jutting cheekbones as he threw back his golden head and unflinchingly met the High King's stern glance.
"Would any have lingered, seeing himself threatened?" replied Pryderi. "Men answer only to an iron fist or a sword at their throats. Those who bear you allegiance bear it as it serves their own ends. Among themselves, these Cantrev rulers are never at peace, but each is eager to profit from the weakness of his neighbour. In their secret hearts, are they less evil than our own Deathlord?"
Shocked and angry murmurs arose from the Cantrev kings. Math silenced them with a quick gesture. Then Gwydion spoke.
"It is beyond any man's wisdom to judge the secret heart of another," he said, "for in it are good and evil mixed. But these are matters to ponder over the embers of a campfire, as you and I have often done, or at the end of feasting, when the torches burn low. Our deeds must now safeguard Prydain. Come, Pryderi, son of Powell. Your place awaits you, and we have many plans to set."
"You summoned me, Prince of Don,"
Pryderi answered in a hard voice.
"I am here. To join you? No. To demand your surrender."
Chapter 11. The Fortress. For an instant, none could speak. The silver bells at the legs of Pryderi's hawks tinkled faintly. Then Taran was on his feet, sword in hand. The Cantrev lords shouted in rage and drew their weapons. Gwydion's voice rang out, commanding them to silence. Pryderi did not move. His retainers had unsheathed their blades and formed a circle about him. The High King had risen from his throne.
"You sport with us, son of Powell," Math said severely. "But treachery is no fitting matter for a jest."
Pryderi still stood with arms folded. His golden features had turned the colour of iron.
"Call it no jest," he answered, "and call me no traitor. This I have pondered long and closely, and with much anguish of heart. I see now that only thus can I serve Prydain."
Gwydion's face was pale, and his eyes grave.
"You speak in madness," he replied. "Have Aron's false promises blinded you to reason? Would you tell me that a liege man of the Death Lord serves any realm but Anuvin?
To me, "Aron can promise nothing I do not already have," answered Pryderi. "But Aron will do what the sons of Don failed to do, make an end of endless wars among the Cantrevs, and bring peace where there was none before. The peace of death and the silence of mute slavery," Gwydion replied.
Pryderi glanced around him. A harsh smile was on his lips.
"Do these men deserve better, Lord Gwydion? Are all their lives together worth one of ours? Crude brawlers, these self-styled Cantrev lords, are unfit to command even their own households. I choose what is best for Prydain," he continued. "I do not serve Aron. Is the axe the woodcutter's master? At the end, it is Aron who will serve me."
With horror, Taran listened to the words of Pryderi as he spoke to the High King.
"Lay down your arms. Abandon the weaklings who cling to you for protection. Surrender to me now. Cair Dathal shall be spared, and yourself, and those I deem worthy to rule with me."
Math raised his head.
"Is there worse evil?" he said in a low voice,
his eyes never leaving Pryderi's.
"Is there worse evil than that which goes in the mask of good?"
One of the Cantrev lords sprang from the council table and, blade upraised, started toward Pryderi.
"Touch him not," cried Math.
"We welcomed him as a friend. He leaves as a foe, but he shall leave in safety. If any harm even a feather of his hawks, his life shall be forfeit."
"Go from here, Pryderi, son of Paul," Gwydion said, the coldness of his tone making his wrath the more terrible. "The anguish of my heart is no less than yours. Our comradeship is broken. Between us there can be only the lines of battle,
and our only bond, the edge of a sword."
Pryderi did not answer, but turned on his heel, and with his retainers strode from the great hall. Even as he mounted his steed, word spread among the warriors, and they stared silently in their ranks. Beyond the walls, the armies of Pryderi had lit torches, and the valley flamed as far as Taran's eyes could see. Pryderi rode through the gates, the crimson and gold of his raiment shimmering like the torches themselves, and galloped toward his waiting host. Taran and the Comet men watched, sick with despair. They knew, as did all in Cair Dathal, this glittering king, like a hawk of death, had snatched their lives and now bore them away with him. Gwydion had expected the army of King Pryderi to attack at first light, and the men in the fortress had labored through the night making ready to withstand a siege. When dawn came, however, and the pale sun rose higher, Pryderi's battle host was seen to have advanced but little. From the wall, Taran, Fluda, and Karl, with the other war leaders, watched beside Gwydion, who stood scanning the valley and the heights that dipped in raw ridges to the flatlands. Snow had not fallen for some days. Gullies and rocky fissures still held streaks and patches of white, caught among the crevices like tufts of wool, but the broad meadowland was, for the most part, clear. The dead turf showed in dark brown splotches under a ragged mantle of frost. Scouts had brought word that Pryderi's warriors held the valley in strength and barred passage through the battle lines. Nevertheless, no skirmishers or flanking columns of riders had been seen abroad, and the scouts judged, from this and the stationing of the foot soldiers and horsemen, that the attack would come in a great forward thrust, as an iron fist against the gates of Cair Dathal. Gwydion nodded.
"Pryderi means to strike in all his might, though it will cost him dearly. He can be spendthrift of his warriors' lives, knowing we can ill afford to pay an equal price."
He frowned and rubbed his chin with the back of a gauntleted hand. His green eyes narrowed as he peered across the valley, and his lined face was that of a wolf scenting his enemies.
"Lord Pryderi is arrogant," he murmured.
Gwydion turned sharply to the war leaders.
"I will not await a siege. To do so would be sure defeat. Pryderi has numbers enough to flood us like a wave. We shall give battle beyond the fortress, and we ourselves strike against the wave before it reaches its crest. Math, son of Mathonwy, shall command the inner defences. Only at the last if so it must be, shall we retreat into the fortress and make our stand there.
Gwydion looked for a long moment at the halls and towers of the castle, which had now caught the early rays of the sun.
The sons of Don raised Caer Dathil with their own hands, and built it not only as a shield against Arawn, but as safeguard for the wisdom and beauty of Prydain. As I would do all in my power to shatter Pryderi, so I would do all to spare Caer Dathil from destruction. It may be that we shall gain both these ends, or lose both. But we must battle not as sluggish oxen, but as swift wolves and cunning foxes.
The Prince of Don spoke quickly to the war leaders, clearly setting forth the tasks of each. Taran felt uneasy. As a boy, he had dreamed of taking a man's place among men, and, as a boy, had deemed himself well fit to do so. Now, amid the grizzled, battle-wise warriors, his strength seemed feeble, his knowledge clouded.
Karl, sensing Taran's thoughts, winked encouragement at him.
The stout old farmer, Taran knew, had paid close heed to Gwydion's words. Yet Taran guessed that a corner of Karl's heart was distant, busily and happily occupied with his turnip patch. For much of the morning Pryderi's host held its position, while the defenders quickly formed their own battle lines. At some distance beyond the walls of Caer Dathil, heavily armed fighting men stood ready to bear the brunt of Pryderi's assault, and there Gwydion himself would command. Fludur and Lian, with Taliesin and a company of warrior bands, held a post across the valley. The Comet Horsemen would be at the flank of Pryderi's attack, and it would be their task to slash into the onrushing wave, to disrupt and sap the strength from the enemy's arms. Taran and Karl at the head of one troop, and Lasser entrusted to lead another, galloped to their stations. Gurgi, silent and shivering in his huge jacket, drove the banner of the White Pig into the frozen ground to mark a rallying point. Taran felt the eyes of the foe watching every move, and an odd impatience, mixed with fear, drew him taut as a bowstring. Gwydion, astride Melingar, rode up for a last glance at the ordering of the Comet Men, and Taran cried out to him,
"Why does Pryderi wait? Does he mock us? Are we no more than ants to him, labouring at a hill, to be crushed at his pleasure?"
"Patience," answered Gwydion, in a tone that was both the reassurance of a friend and the command of a war leader. "You are swords added to my hands," Gwydion went on. "Do not let yourselves be shattered. Move quickly. Stay not overlong in one fray, but start many."
He took Taran's hand and Karl's and Gurgi's.
"Farewell," Gwydion said, almost brusquely, then spun Melingar about and rode swiftly to his warriors.
Taran watched him until he had disappeared, then turned toward the distant towers of Caer Dathil. Ailanwy, along with Glu, had been commanded to remain in the fortress under the High King's protection. Taran strained his eyes in the vain hope of glimpsing her on the walls. What she might feel for him, he was no more sure than he had been at Caer Dalban. But, despite his resolve, he was on the verge of speaking his own heart fully. Then, suddenly, like a man swept away in a flood, he had been caught up in the rallying of warriors, without even a moment to say his farewell. Yearning pierced him, and regret for his unspoken words was an iron hand gripping his throat. He started, and clenched the reins as Melinlas, snorting a white cloud, began to paw the ground. At a glance, he saw Pryderi's host had risen, and was surging into the valley. The battle was upon him. It came quickly, not as the slow cresting wave Taran had expected. First was a swelling sea of shouting men. The sons of Don were not awaiting Pryderi's charge, but were racing ahead to grapple with the attacking foe. He saw Gwydion on the rearing white shape of Melingar, but Taran could not tell the instant of the first clash of arms. For in a moment, instead of two tides, there was only one that spun and shifted in a great convulsion, a whirlpool of spears and swords. Taran sounded his horn and, as an answering shout came from Lasser, clapped heels into the flanks of Melinlas. Karl and the Comet Horsemen spurred their mounts after him. From a swift canter, the powerful legs of Melinlas stretched to a gallop. The stallion's muscles heaved beneath him, and Taran, sword raised, plunged into the sea of men. His head spun, and he gasped as if drowning. He realized he was terrified. Around him swirled the faces of friends and foes. He glimpsed Lonio flailing right and left. The man's makeshift helmet bobbed over his eyes. His long legs were drawn up high in the stirrups, and he looked like nothing so much as a scarecrow come to life. Yet, where Lonio passed, attackers fell as wheat to a scythe. Hevid's burly frame rose like a wall in the midst of the combat. Of Lassa there was no sign, but Taran thought he could hear the young shepherd's high-pitched battle cry. Then a curious roaring reached his ears, and he knew Lian, with Fluda, had entered the fray. In another moment, aware of nothing beyond the blade in his hand, Taran was locked in a blind madness with warriors who thrust at him and whose blows he strove to return. Again and again, Taran and the Comet Horsemen slashed deep into the attacker's flanks, then wheeled to gallop free of the iron whirlpool, only to plunge back again. In a flash of clarity, Taran saw glittering gold and crimson. It was King Prideri on a black charger. Taran struggled to engage him. For an instant, their eyes met, but the son of Powell made no attempt to answer the challenge of a ragged horseman. Instead, he looked away and continued to press ahead. Then he was gone, and it was Prideri's scornful glance that stung Taran more sharply than the blade which swung up from the mass of foemen to lash across his face. Once, the swell of the armed tide flung Taran to the fringes of the battle. He caught sight of Gurgi's banner and tried to rally the horsemen around it. A trough had opened up amid Prideri's ranks. In another moment, a horse pounded toward him. Luagor. A warrior armed with a long lance clung to the steed's back. "Go back!" Taran shouted at the top of his voice. "Have you lost your wits?" Ailanwi, for it was she, half-halted. She had tucked her plaited hair under a leather helmet. The Princess of Leia smiled cheerfully at him.
"I understand you're upset," she shouted back, "but that's no cause to be rude."
She galloped on. For a time, Taran could not believe he had really seen her. Moments later, he was struggling against a band of warriors who slashed at Melinless, threw themselves against the stallion's flanks, and strove to bear down horse and rider. Taran was vaguely aware of someone seizing his mount's bridle and dragging him to the side. Prideri's warriors fell away. Free of the press, he turned in the saddle and blindly flung up his sword against the new attacker. It was Carl. The stout farmer had lost his helmet. His bald crown was as scratched as if he had plunged headlong into briars.
"Save your sword for your foes, not your friends," he cried.
Taran's surprise left him speechless an instant, before he stammered, "You saved my life, Carl, son of Carlfruhr."
"Why, so perhaps I did," replied Carl, as though the idea had suddenly come to him.
They looked at each other, and burst out laughing like a pair of fools. Only towards sundown, when the sky itself seemed streaked with blood, did Taran gain a new sense of the battle. Gwydion's warriors, flung across the path of Prideri's advance, had met the full fury of their attackers. The hosts of Prideri had faltered, as though stumbling over their own dead. The wave had crested and hung poised. Now a fresh wind surged over the valley. Taran's heart leapt as shouts of renewed strength rang from the warriors of Don. They pressed onward, driving all before them. Taran sounded his horn, and with the Comet Horsemen, galloped to join the sweeping tide. The ranks of the enemy parted like a shattered wall. Taran clutched at his reins. Melinless reared and whinnied in alarm. A shudder of horror racked the valley. Taran saw and understood why, even before the rising current of outcries reached his ears.
"The Cauldronborn! The Deathless Warriors!"
The men of Prideri fell back to let them pass, as if in fearful homage. In ghastly silence, their pace neither fast nor slow, the Cauldronborn filled the breach, and the valley rang with the tread of their heavy boots. In the crimson haze of the dying sun, their faces seemed all the more livid. Their eyes were cold and dull as stones. Unfaltering, the column of deathless warriors bore toward Caer Dathil. Among them, slung about with ropes, they carried an iron-capped battering ram. The foemen, flanking the Cauldronborn, now turned suddenly to launch a fresh attack against the Sons of Don. In horror, Taran realized why Pryderi had delayed, and understood his arrogance. Only now had the traitor king's plan reached its fulfillment. Behind the long column of Cauldronborn, fresh fighting men streamed from the heights. For Pryderi, the long day of battle had been no more than a mockery. The slaughter had begun. At the fortress, bowmen and spearmen of the inner defences thronged the walls. The mute Cauldronborn did not falter in the storm of arrows. Though every shaft found its mark, the foe moved steadily onward, pausing only to rip the arrows from their unbleeding flesh. Their features showed neither pain nor anger, and no human cry, no shout of triumph, passed their lips. From Anuvin they had journeyed, as though from the grave. Their task only to bring death, unpitying, implacable as their own lifeless faces. Against the pounding of the battering ram, the gates of Caer Dathil groaned and trembled. The massive hinges loosened, while echoes of the driving ram shuddered through the fortress. The portal splintered, the first breach gaped like a wound. The Cauldronborn gathered strength once more to force the ram forward. The gates of Caer Dathil shattered and fell inward. Trapped between the ranks of Pryderi's warriors, the Sons of Don fought vainly to reach the fortress. Sobbing with fury and despair, Taran, helpless, saw the Cauldronborn stride past the broken gates. Before them stood Math, the High King. He was attired in the raiment of the royal house, belted with links of gold, and on his brow glittered the gold crown of Don. About his shoulders was a cloak of fine white wool, wrapped as though it were a burial garment. Outstretched, his withered hand gripped a naked sword. The deathless warriors of Anuvin halted, as if at the faint stirring of some clouded memory. The moment passed, and they strode on. The field of battle was silent now. An awed hush had fallen even upon the men of Pryderi. The High King did not turn away as the Cauldronborn drew closer, his eyes fixed theirs as he raised his sword defiantly. Unflinching, he stood in pride and ancient majesty. The first of the pallid warriors was upon him. Grasping the flashing sword in his frail hands, the High King swung it downward in a sweeping blow. The warrior's blade turned it aside, and the Cauldronborn struck heavily. King Math staggered and dropped to one knee. The mass of mute warriors pressed forward, their weapons thrusting and slashing. Taran covered his face with his hands and turned away weeping, as Math, son of Mathonwy, fell and the iron-shod boots of the Cauldronborn pressed their relentless march over his lifeless body. From the dark hills then there rose the long notes of a hunting horn, trembling, echoing among the crags, and a shadow seemed to brush the sky above the fortress. Now, behind the Cauldronborn, the men of Pryderi streamed through the broken gates, while waves of attackers drove the remnants of Gwydion's army into the heights, scattering them amid snow-filled gullies. From Caer Dathil came new claps of thunder as the ram of the Cauldronborn turned against the walls to breach them in turn. Flames rose above the great hall, above the Hall of Law, and from the middle tower was unfurled the crimson hawk of Pryderi. Beside it, blotting out the dying sun, spread the black banner of Aron, Lord of Anuvin. Caer Dathil had fallen. Chapter 12. The Red Fallows. All night the destruction raged, and by morning Caer Dathil lay in ruins. Fires smouldered where once had stood the lofty halls. The swords and axes of the Cauldronborn had levelled the hemlock grove near the Mounds of Honour. In the dawn light the shattered walls seemed bloodstained. The army of Pryderi, denying even the right of burial for the slain, had driven the defenders into the hills east of Caer Dathil. It was there, amid the turmoil of the makeshift camp, the companions found one another again. Faithful Gergi still bore the banner of the White Pig, though its staff had been broken and the emblem slashed almost beyond recognition. Lian, with Fluda beside her, crouched in the scant shelter of a rocky outcropping. Her tail twitched, and her yellow eyes still glowed with anger. Hevid the Smith built a campfire, and Taran, Ailanwy, and Karl tried to warm themselves at the embers. Lassa, though sorely wounded, had lived through the battle, but the enemy had taken cruel toll of the Comet Men. Among those who lay stark and silent on the trampled battleground was Lonio, son of Lonwen. One of the handful of survivors from the inner defences of the fortress was Glue. A warrior of Don, finding him lost and dazed outside the walls, had taken pity on his plight and brought him to the camp. The former giant was pathetically glad to rejoin the companions, though he was still too terrified and trembling to do more than mumble a few words. With a torn cloak over his shoulders, he huddled beside the fire and held his head in his hands. Gwydion stood alone. For long his eyes did not leave the column of black smoke staining the sky above the ruins of Caer Dathil. At last he turned away, and ordered all who had lived out the day to assemble. Taliesin came to stand before them, and, taking up Fluda's harp, sang a lament for the slain. Amid the black pines the voice of the chief bard rose in deep sorrow. Yet it was sorrow without despair. And while the notes of the harp were heavy laden with mourning, they held as well the clear strains of life and hope. As the melody died away, Taliesin lifted his head and spoke quietly. "Each broken stone of Caer Dathil shall be a mark of honour, and the whole valley a resting place for Math, son of Mathonwy, and all our dead. But a high king still lives. As I honour him, so do I honour all who stand with him." He turned to Gwydion and bowed deeply. The warriors drew their swords and cried out the name of the new king of Prydain. Gwydion then called the companions to him. "We meet only to part," he said. "Pryderi's victory gives us one choice and one hope. Though messengers bear tidings of our defeat to King Smoit and his army, and to the lords of the north, we dare not await their help. What we do must be done now. Not even a battle host tenfold greater than Pryderi's can withstand the Cauldron Born. Army after army can be flung against them, only to swell the ranks of the slain. Yet here is the seed of our hope," Gwydion said. "Never in man's memory has Aron sent his deathless warriors abroad in such strength. He has taken the greatest risk for the greatest gain, and he has triumphed. But his triumph has become his moment of greatest weakness. Without the Cauldron Born to guard it, Anuvin lies open to attack. So must we attack it." "Do you believe then that Anuvin is unguarded?" Taran asked quickly. "Are there none other who serve Aron?" "Mortal warriors, surely," replied Gwydion, "and perhaps a force of huntsmen. But we have strength to overcome them, if the Cauldron Born do not reach Anuvin in time to aid them." Gwydion's blood-streaked face was hard as stone. "They must not reach Anuvin. As their power dwindles the longer they remain beyond the Death Lord's realm, so at all cost must they be hindered, delayed, turned from every path they follow."
Karl nodded.
"Indeed. This is our only hope, whatever. And it must be done quickly, for now they will seek to return quickly to their master. But can we overtake them once they are on their march? Can we hinder them and at the same time mount our own attack against Anuvin?"
"Not if we journey as one army," Gwydion said. "Instead, we must separate into two bands. The first and smaller shall be given as many horses as can be spared, and hasten to pursue the Cauldron Born. The second shall make their way to the valley of Kinvile and follow its river northwest to the coast. The valley land is gentle, and with forced marches the sea can be reached in no more than 2 days. The sea must aid our venture," Gwydion continued, "for Pryderi can too easily forbid our army's journey overland.
He turned to Taran. Math, son of Mathonwy, spoke to you of the ships that bore the sons of Don from the summer country. These vessels were not abandoned. Still seaworthy, they have ever been held ready against a day of need. A faithful folk guard them in a hidden harbour near the mouth of the river Kinvile. They will carry us to the western shore of Prydain, close to the bastions of Anuvin itself. Two men alone have knowledge of the harbour, Gwydion added. One was Math, son of Mathonwy. The other is myself. I have no choice but to lead the seaward march. As for the other journey, he said to Taran, will you accept to lead it? Taran raised his head. I serve as you command. I do not command this, replied Gwydion. I order no man to such a task against his will, and all who follow you must do so willingly. Then it is my will to do so, Taran answered. The companions murmured their assent. The vessels of the Sons of Don are swift, Gwydion said. I ask you to delay the Cauldronborn but a little while. Yet all hangs on that little. If I fail, Taran said, how shall I send word to you? Should the Cauldron warriors reach Anuvin ahead of you, your plan cannot succeed, and you must turn back. Gwydion shook his head. There can be no turning back, for there is no further hope. Should either of us fail, all our lives are forfeit. Lassa, Hevid, and all the other Comet folk chose to follow Taran. With them were joined the surviving warriors of Fluda Flem, and together they made the greater portion of Taran's band. To the surprise of the companions, Glued chose to ride with them. The former giant had recovered from his fright, at least enough to regain much of his customary peevishness. He had, however, regained all of his appetite, and demanded food in great quantity from Gergi's wallet of provisions.
"I've had my fill of being dragged here and there by the scruff of the neck,"
said Glue, licking his fingers.
"And now I'm either to be put on a ship or cast among a herd of horses. Very well, I shall take the latter, for at least it's not so wet and salty. But I assure you, I would have agreed to neither when I was a giant."
Fluda glowered at the former giant and spoke apart with Taran.
"It seems we're doomed, on top of all our other woes, to put up with that whining weasel at every step. And I can't help feeling that in the back of that puny little mind he's hoping somehow to feather his own nest."
The bard shook his head and gave Taran a sorrowful look.
"But aren't any nests left to feather? There's not a safe place even for Glue to hide his head."
Gergi had tied the banner of the white pig to a new staff, but he sighed mournfully at the tattered emblem.
"Poor piggy," he cried. "None can see her now, for she is torn into threadings and shreddings."
"I promised to sew another," Ilanwy said, "as soon as—"
She stopped abruptly, and said no more as she climbed astride Luagor. Taran saw her troubled glance. The Princess of Lea would wait long, he feared, before her hands worked with an embroidery needle. And, unspoken but in his heart, was the dread that none of them might see Caer Dalban again. At the end of their grim race, death might be the only prize. Armed with spears and swords, the warriors were mounted and ready. With a last farewell to Gwydion, the companions rode westward from the hills. It was Carl's judgment that the Cauldronborn would march directly to Anuvin, following the straightest and shortest path. At the head of the column, winding its way from the snow-swept heights, Lassa rode beside Taran. The skill of the young shepherd eased their passage, and he guided them swiftly toward the lowlands, unseen by Pryderi's army, which had begun to withdraw from the valley around Caer Dathil. For some days they journeyed, and Taran began to fear the retreating Cauldronborn had outdistanced them. Nevertheless, they could do no more than press on as quickly as possible, southward now, passing through long stretches of sparse woodland. It was Gergi who first sighted the deathless warriors. The creature's face went grey with fright as he pointed to an expanse of rock-strewn plain. Glue blinked, choked, and could barely swallow the food he was munching. Ilanwy watched silently, and the bard gave a low whistle of dismay. Taran's heart sank at the sight of the column moving like a long serpent over the flatlands. He turned questioningly to Karl. "Can we hold them off at all?"
"A pebble can turn aside an avalanche," said Karl, "or a twig stem a flood."
"I dare say,"